ACL injuries can end careers for professional athletes and certainly limit physical activity for the rest of us, for me and for you. Today we'll talk about why they can be so hard to rebound from and how physical therapy can help. Larry Mueller here, my guest today, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori, physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health's Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, great to have you back.
It is good to be here on a lovely day.
On a beautiful day.
The last days of summer.
That's right.
Yes. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Jill, great to have you back as well.
It's nice to be here.
And, of course, they join us every month to answer your physical therapy questions. You may have recovered from an ACL injury. Maybe you haven't. Wish you had. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Well, maybe we should start just by talking about what an ACL injury is. Jill, do you want to take that?
You bet. Well, the ACL is the anterior cruciate ligament, which lives in the knee and is unfortunately the most commonly ruptured ligament in the body. It's ruptured or torn with planting or twisting. So the lower leg kind of goes one way and the body and the upper leg goes another way. We know, unfortunately, a lot of the injuries are through what we call non-contact. So in other words, it's not because you're colliding with another athlete or another individual. Literally, you're running and you're playing soccer, basketball, and you do a sudden plant and twist movement without anyone touching you, and your knee experiences kind of a shear force, and it tears your ACL.
I think the quarterback for the Vikings, didn't he have it? That was the situation with him. He had no physical contact, just made a turn.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's the situation in most occasions. And a lot of the attention in the medical community in the past has been directed toward prevention programs, teaching athletes how to land from a jump, how to cut and change directions in a way that's safer for their knee. But that still isn't
that's not enough.
But it's a big step forward.
I would assume you'd see it in sports like soccer or football.
Soccer and basketball are the two probably most common per athlete exposure where people tear their ACL. And even within those two sports that are played on identical courts, women experience ACL tears at rates anywhere, depending on who you read in the literature, of 5 to 7 times that of their male counterparts.
And why is that?
If you could answer that question, Larry, we could all retire.
Right.
Unfortunately, there's lots of different factors, including intrinsic factors due to the shape of the female's knee. We know their ACL is smaller. Kind of the notch that the ACL travels through is a little bit smaller in women. They've tried to pin it on hormones. And then there's
always try to pin it on
exactly.
hormones.
Exactly. Everything's pinned on hormones. And then there's some extrinsic factors, too. Mm-hmm. Some strength, flexibility, things like that.
Right. You know, you think about it. If you wanted to generalize to athletes, women tend to be more flexible than men.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some who believe that stiffness that the men have, that lack of flexibility in their hamstrings that keep them in a little bit of a flexed position, is to their benefit as compared to the women. Because hyperextension is one of the main causes of an ACL injury. Jill said you have the plant and twist, but hyperextension is another one. So the girl who comes down and her knee doesn't flex appropriately, but in fact it goes backwards, that's another way to tear your ACL.
Ouch.
Right.
How do you treat it?
Well, I shouldn't say most, but the majority of people, if you want to resume high-level activity like playing soccer or basketball, most of those people have to go on and have it reconstructed. In other words, they don't repair the tissue that's there. They take out your old ACL and you get a new one. And that new one can be from somewhere in your body, so it could be your patellar tendon. They'd harvest part of that, your hamstrings, your quad tendon. And then the other thing they're doing now is they're doing quite a bit of allografts where they actually use a patellar tendon graft from a cadaver. And they use that. So there's different materials or different substances they can use to reconstruct the ACL.
And surgery, not always necessary, is it?
Not always necessary. So the people who are kind of what we call copers are typically people who, like Lori said, have more stiffness. They're not as flexible. They have a tendency to be a little older and maybe not going back to such higher level activities. Like the classic people, I remember one of my favorite patients, not they're all my favorite, just let me get that out there.
Right.
But when I had a patient who was in his mid-50s who tore his ACL, his big dog bound into him, hyperextended his knee, kind of a sedentary job. And the only thing activity-wise he needed to do is he liked to do a lot of walking and he liked to hunt and get in and out of a tree stand. So he did just fine with some really good conservative rehabilitation, getting him stronger, working on his balance, and he never went on to have his ACL reconstructed.
You know, we just got a Facebook message from Lucia, who would like to know if there's life after injury when someone isn't an athlete. To begin with, she would like to participate in things like 5Ks, but needs to repair and strengthen first. Is there hope? She's 52, tired of watching everybody else have fun.
Oh, is that an ACL injury or just any injury?
She doesn't mention the type of injury.
Well, you know,
ACL, ACL.
Okay, so if it is an ACL, you know, things like a 5K, you know, that's a pretty straightforward activity. You're not cutting, you're not starting and stopping, you're not changing directions. Those are the things that really challenge your ACL. Straightforward running should be something that she's able to return to. You know, one of the biggest risk factors for people who have torn their ACL, if they haven't torn their meniscus or the cushion between their two bones, they'll have a better prognosis down the road. Those who tear their ACL and their meniscus go on to develop osteoarthritis in that joint at a rate that far exceeds people who don't tear their meniscus. So one of the things that we have to be aware of for these people who have torn their ACL is what's the risk of a meniscus injury. And so if she was returning to activities that would put her meniscus at risk, and that is planting, twisting, pivoting, jumping, things like that, then we'd use a little more caution and make sure that she was fully rehabilitated and that her knee was stable before she went back to activities. But with a good rehabilitation program and the absence of a meniscus injury, she should be able to return to activities like a 5K.
And another activity that would be great for her is biking. So it's non-impact. That's another activity for her that would be low risk for her knee. So there's definitely options out there for her to get back and do things, no doubt.
I try to do 5Ks most every morning.
There you go.
Perfect.
Oh, jinx.
Oh, yeah, jinx. I just got it. Actually, not every morning. I just got my app, Map My Run, sent me a three-year anniversary and said, oh, you've done a couple thousand miles.
Nice.
Isn't that great?
Congratulations.
It's nice to have that that sort of input from
reinforcement.
How many times you ran, 700 or whatever, and it's just... It's nice.
That's nice because you get up in the morning and you go, oh, do I really have to put one foot in front of the other this morning? But, you know, it's nice to have that reinforcement to say, wow,
I did.
And that's great.
Pat in Elm Grove has a question for us. Let's go there. Pat, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you for taking my call. About a week ago, I noticed stiffness in my knee, and I can walk easily a mile or a mile and a half, but when I go down steps, it's sort of painful. I can go up steps without any pain, but going down, and icing does seem to help.
Did you have some kind of an injury to your knee?
No, not at all.
You just woke up with it one day like that.
Right.
Well, in terms of stiffness in your joint, it's going to be easier to go up because your knee doesn't have to go through as great a range of motion as you do when you go down the stairs.
Right.
So does it seem like it's getting better?
Yes, I would say so if I ice it a lot.
Yeah, I'd keep an eye on it. You know, you could have some underlying arthritis and maybe, you know, you did a little twisting or maybe you were on your feet more than you realized you were and you stirred things up. And, you know, I would say in the absence of an injury, if you are on a trajectory for getting better, I'd kind of stick with your program. I'd continue to walk. I'd continue to be active and ice it periodically. And if you're not turning the corner, go in and see someone.
Yep.
Agreed.
For sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Lynette and Madison up next. Hi, Lynette. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm training for half marathon, and I am getting pain in the back of my Achilles, or in my Achilles, and I've had this pain before, and I just went and was told I have tight calf muscles, but also I tried some dry needling at one point. So I guess I'm wondering if it's still going on, and it's probably at a level 5 or 6 when I'm running.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if there's anything else that I need to be aware of, or if I should give it up totally, which I don't want to.
Well, that's a million-dollar question. Is you're training for a half. When is the half? Where are you in your mileage?
I just did 7 yesterday, and it's November 13th. Mm-hmm.
That's the Madison half, right?
Oh. Mm-hmm. I was like, how did you know that?
I ate it yesterday afterwards, and it feels okay today, but I know it's still there, low level, you know?
So what kind of surfaces are you running on? Are you running on a banked road? Can you attribute it to that? I mean, it's always kind of a question when you get it in one side and not the other.
Yeah. You know, when I really noticed it, I love doing hills and speed work, and so that's when I noticed it really came on. And
right.
So I'm trying not to do hills.
Right. Those are good things to avoid. You know, if I were you, it sounds like you've seen a physical therapist in the past if you've had dry needling. Is that correct?
Yes. And it didn't work.
Oh, it didn't?
Then
okay.
I went, not really much. And then I went to a sports medicine doctor I think that's who I saw. And then he mentioned that my calves were really tight. Right away he noticed that.
Okay.
So then I've been just hanging on the side of a step, you know, with my heel down.
Okay.
Is it getting better?
You know, I don't know, because I've started increasing my mileage.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if it will ever go away.
Well, not as long as you're running, at the distance you're running, and not as long as you're training. I would say, no, it's not going to get better. Because of the deceleration loads, you know, you get tendinopathies. May I ask how old you are?
Yeah, 53.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry.
Starting to set in.
Yeah. Got it. Tendinopathy, you know, it's fairly classic in, I will say, our age group. And it develops in a lot of decelerative activities. So if you're doing hills and you're putting it on tension, if you're running and you're decelerating your body every stride when you do that, it's probably not going to get better. So the question is, do you want to gut it out now until the marathon and just treat it afterwards, or do you want to cut back on your running and see if you can get over it and still run the half? I mean, that's sort of the decision you have to make. You can cross train, you can bike, you can train in a pool and keep yourself in, you know, cardiorespiratory shape for the half. And your tendonitis will calm some, but I don't think it's going to go away as long as you're training.
Probably not.
Yeah.
Am I doing more damage if I continue to train?
Damage, yes or no. The longer a tendinopathy hangs around, the harder it is to get rid of and the more likely it is to come back, because you get changes in the tendon from long-standing inflammation.
Right.
Yeah. So you get some changes in the tendon, and how well the tendon recovers from that is a bit of a crapshoot. You know, it has to do with body weight, your heredity, what kind of connective tissue your parents gave you.
How you load the rest of the activities you're doing.
Your body weight. There's a lot of factors. How many times you've been through this cycle. So, you know, is it going to kill you? Are you never going to be able to run again after the half? No, probably not. You'll get over it. It'll just take a little longer.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Do I have time for one more question?
You know, the other thing I would do, Lynette, if you try to heel lift. Okay. All right.
I have inserts and stuff like
okay.
that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. All right.
Yeah.
I don't know, Larry.
Time for one more question.
Okay, quick one.
The top of my knee, I'm starting to know where it connects to the quads.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to notice a little pain there. Is that with age as well?
Same side?
No, both knees.
Oh, God. Man, you're a walking tendinopathy.
Right. Yeah.
So
oh my God.
Yeah, your body's not liking this. So you might want to think about just incorporating some cross training, because if you continue to train, all of these may work together to shut
perfect
you down
storm.
For the half.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say explode.
That's the right word.
I know, and I hate to use it, but
you
could get an implosion.
All right.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah. We totally made your day, didn't we?
Yeah.
So sorry to be the bear of not so good news.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks for calling. I just all this talk about Lynette's issues made me think back to Lucia's on Facebook with wanting to do a 5K and
right.
so forth with an
mm-hmm.
ACL. But shouldn't she start? She can walk a 5K
sure,
right
mm-hmm,
now. She
sure.
should start. Wouldn't mm-hmm. you? Wouldn't you have her start? I wouldn't have her start running. Would I? Would
right.
You
have to. You have to dose these things very appropriately and see how the knee tolerates it. So the first thing that the individual on Facebook should do is see a physical therapist so her strength can be assessed, her balance, her motion, and then based on those things, she may be able to start like an intermittent walk jog program.
Yeah.
But it's all about dosing and how much load can I put through that knee that it tolerates.
Yeah.
And this last caller is a perfect example of her tendons don't like
yeah.
how much she's loading.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, she might be one of those people that to train for a half K instead of needing 2 months, she may need more like 4 to 6 because mm-hmm. her tendons take longer to get used to those kind of loads. Or
mm-hmm.
like Lori said, be a permanent cross trainer.
Mm-hmm.
So I can run that half, but I'm only going to train running half of the workouts. The other half I do with biking, things like that.
Okay, there
yeah.
we go. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today, physical therapists, as we talk about recovering from an ACL injury and a whole lot more. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nador, on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn will talk with her guests about why so many American workers don't have sick leave and how other countries deal with that situation. Right now, taking a look at physical therapy with Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, how to recover from an ACL injury or a whole lot more. Call in at 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. Connie and Portage up next. Hi, Connie. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question. I'm a nurse, and I don't like to go to doctors. And I tore my meniscus, and so I just babied it, and it healed. It's been 2 years ago, and I don't have any arthritis. Now, is that usual?
Well, that's a great question, and part of the meniscus can actually heal on its own. So part of the meniscus actually has a little blood supply to it, the outer third. And so if you had a tear kind of in that periphery and those ends kind of found each other, it can certainly heal. It's the tears that are kind of in the meniscus in the deep, deep inside of the meniscus where there's no blood supply that don't go on to heal. So there are certainly people who have probably very small micro tears in their meniscus and they're in where that blood supply is, and yes, they can go on to heal.
And the other interesting side of that is even if they don't heal, in many cases they're better off left alone in the knee. As long as you're not getting locking or catching where you have a piece of meniscus that's flipping around in the joint and getting caught in the joint, even if it's torn, if it's behaving, so to speak, and staying in place, it provides a valuable support for the knee joint itself and helps with the nutrition and helps protect the articular cartilage from further deterioration. So even if you had a tear and it didn't heal, if it's not giving you mechanical symptoms, you're better off leaving it in.
Thank you so much. I just thought people should know there are other alternatives besides going to the hospital and having surgery.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So you should be asking if you go to the
right.
see the doctor,
right.
where on the meniscus is the tear?
Yeah. Well, where is it? How? And the type of tear, sometimes the direction of the tear is also a factor in is it going to heal on its own? And there are some tears that we know will not heal. And if they're called a bucket handle or they have a flap, those are the ones that usually give people problems. Because like Lori said, they flip up into the joint space. Then you get some locking in your knee. But, you know, it's kind of like a hangnail. You know, if you brush one way, you don't catch it. If you brush the other way, you do.
Yeah.
So if you always load your knee the way where you don't catch it, it can yep. be just fine.
Yeah. And a good surgeon won't operate on
right.
A torn meniscus that is asymptomatic.
Right.
Hmm.
Right.
There we go.
Yeah.
Mike in Oconomowoc, thanks for calling. Your turn now.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate it. I've got a brief 30-year history to give you. When I was 25, I was playing softball and collided with another outfielder, got hit in the front of the knee, and had a partial tear of my ACL and tore my meniscus. And so they took the chunk of my meniscus out and just immobilized me for the ACL at that time.
For
8 weeks.
Oh, yes. Remember those days.
I had a pretty good recovery from that for like 20 years. I worked back so that I wasn't even having to wear the ACL brace when I played basketball and that sort of thing. But then about 10 years ago, I started to get a sharp stabbing pain in that knee once in a while, and the doctor thought I had some more meniscus issues, so went in to clean it up. And my ACL, he told me after the surgery, was lax. And my ACL felt a lot worse after that meniscus surgery than it had prior to going in. And since then, I've been, last like 5 years or so, I've had a lot of lack of motion in that knee where I only can go about halfway up to my butt with my heel. And then just real stiffness, and I think it's probably arthritis. Standing up, you know, when I do it. So I've been trying to do some things like one-footed leg presses, you know, where I'm just standing off of a stair and going down, touching my heel to the floor below.
Well, what
that sort of thing.
So you've had two meniscectomies, is that
correct?
Where they've so that right there is they've taken out, you know, part of the cushion that helps absorb shock in your knee. And 30 years ago, surgeons were not conservative about how much chunk of your meniscus they took out, and we've learned that they would take out potentially the entire half of the meniscus of your knee. And then you'd end up with bone on bone. So what probably happened in your first surgery is they took out a very large portion of your meniscus, not realizing that we needed to spare as much as we could. And perhaps the second go around when you took out a little bit more, it was just enough to kind of, it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back.
Exactly. And you think about loading of your knee joint. When people gain weight over the course of their lifetime, which is something that we frequently see, your knee can slowly adapt to that change. But when you go in and overnight take out a section of the meniscus, you change the loading pattern across that knee joint immediately and abruptly. And how well your joint surface can adapt to that abrupt change kind of determines what your outcome is going to be. And frankly, You must be in your 50s if you had it 30 years ago. The older we get, the less adaptable our joint surfaces are. The turnover rate of our joint surfaces is very low and slow in that age group.
So I wonder if something like what I had, Synvisc, which is that gel into I mean, that was just like a miracle for me.
Well, the Synvisc injections for arthritis have a somewhat narrow range of applications. So not everyone with arthritis in their knee would be a candidate for that. That would be a call by the surgeon to look at the knee and say whether or not they were a candidate for that. But, you know, in a recent prospective study found that people with combined ACL meniscus injuries, 57% of them developed osteoarthritis, significant osteoarthritis 20 years later. So it is less truly about the ACL and much more about your loss of the meniscus that drives the that drives the arthritis in your knee.
Do you have a suggestion?
Yes, I do.
I could do?
Yes, I do. A, maintain a healthy body weight.
So I'm within about 5 pounds of when I was 25.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Good for you. You need to continue that. You need to have strong quadriceps because they're the shock absorbers of your knee. And it would be worthwhile to see a physical therapist to find out safe ways to strengthen your quadriceps in the presence of your meniscus injury and your ACL, because there are some strengthening exercises that will place too much stress on your joint surfaces and others that are safer. So I would make an appointment or two to see somebody and talk about strategies to lower your risk of further arthritis in that knee.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's turn to Judy and Racine next. Hi, Judy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I have a 17-year-old granddaughter who lives with me, and I'm sure this isn't the technical term, but looking at her, she looks to be knock-kneed. And she sometimes complains of knee pain, and I was wondering if there are things she should or should not be doing.
So she's 17. Did she just recently go through a growth spurt? Does she have really long, lanky legs, anything like that?
No, I think she's pretty much done.
Done growing? Okay.
She's 5'8".
Okay. So that we call that knee valgus, where the knees come together like that. And it, the reasoning for that is multifactorial. If sometimes it's a bony chemistry, so how your bones are put together, that your bones are actually more shaped in that position. And for that, you really can't do anything. Another reason is due to weakness in the hip. And then if they have very, very flat feet. So sometimes looking at the joint above and the joint below to kind of realign the whole chain are good strategies. So have you ever noticed, is she really flat-footed when she stands?
I don't think so, but I mean, I haven't really looked carefully,
sure.
I guess.
Sure. Well, it may be worth having her see a physical therapist to look and see if she has some weakness in her hips that could be addressed. And then also if she needs just a simple, like, off-the-shelf orthotic or a different type of tennis shoe or support to kind of realign her whole lower chain.
Oh, you don't think sliders are the best, huh?
Sliders.
You know, those...
Flip-flops?
Nike. No, not...
Oh, the slides? Yeah, the slides, no.
Are they called? That's what
yeah,
they call
yeah,
them.
Yeah, yeah. No, she needs shoes with good support.
Yeah.
The other thing...
Tell her you said so.
Tell her we said so. And also,
we're both mothers.
And we're both... Yes, we both have daughters, so...
Okay.
Also know that when you have that kind of malalignment in your lower extremities and you walk around like that all your life, she will be at a higher risk for developing arthritis when she's older.
Because of
the inequitable load distribution across her knee joint.
And she already said she's having some knee pain.
Right.
So
she's only 17.
That might motivate her to kind of do something about it.
Yeah.
Okay. She used to play basketball, but boy, getting her to do things now is not easy.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck, Judy.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Jim and Stevens Point will turn to you next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My question has to do with a stress fracture in my foot. And somehow I developed a stress fracture right where the little toe, base of the little toe meets the base of the second toe next to it. And so I'm in a very large boot,
mm-hmm.
and I'm spending my next 6 to 8 weeks on a little wheeler in my house.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
My question really is, what can I expect once this comes off and hopefully it heals, and should I be doing anything differently? I walk a lot, I bike, I swim. So I'm just kind of wondering what I can expect when this boot comes off.
Well, let's back up for just a second and talk about, did you increase your activity or have a change in your activity that caused you to have the stress fracture in the first place?
Well, I had gone actually fishing to Alaska and spent an extra day in the little town I was in, seeing the Alaskan wilderness, and walked a lot in probably shoes that weren't the greatest for walking. And that's all of a sudden it just started to hurt.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
All right. So yeah, so at least we understand that it's not some underlying metabolic issue. So what to do? So realize that everything that's immobilized in that boot, not just the stress fracture, although we tend to focus on the stress fracture, but everything has been immobilized. Your ankle, your calf muscles, the rest of the bones in your foot. So returning to activity gradually and loading that gradually is going to be really important. The general rule of thumb is that when something is immobilized, it takes twice the amount of time of remobilization for it to return to its baseline level. So going out and saying, okay, great, I'm out of my boot, now I'm going to go pick up where I left off, is not going to be good, because you may end up with a stress fracture someplace else, or a tendinopathy or some other kind of an issue.
Okay.
So again, seeing somebody to walk you through what's the right pace, what are the right things to look for as you return to activity, what are the red flags, would be really useful to get you back into some activity. Getting in a pool, doing some unweighted exercise, doing some bicycling to load it without your full weight bearing are great ways to initiate activity without overloading.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you do a lot of those activities. So
yeah,
it's just a matter of finding
about 4 times a week. So that's kind of my big exercise.
Yeah.
Great. So it's just a matter of finding how to combine all those things to give you the appropriate amount of loading. So it's just the right amount of load, so everything kind of remodels back to baseline.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks very much. So 8 weeks in a boot, 16 weeks then probably to kind of get back to normal, maybe, if you do things right.
If you do things right, yep.
All right, Brittany in Wauwatosa, your turn. Hi, Brittany.
Hi,
what's on your mind?
So I had a question. I wanted to get your take on some hip pain that I just started having within the last 24 hours.
Okay.
It's just my right hip, and I woke up this morning. It was really sore, and it was clicking a little bit. The clicking has gone away as the day has gone on. But then I noticed every time I put weight on it, it hurts, and it almost, when I went to press on my hip and massage it a little bit, it almost feels like there's a depression when I put weight on it. It kind of, there's a spot where it goes in, and that's not, I couldn't feel it on the left side. Hmm. And then just in addition to that, I guess I have been having some lower back pain for the last 2 weeks, so I don't know if maybe they're related. I did some running, and I opened a window, which I think is what triggered the back pain.
Yeah, and you're young.
Yeah, I'm 26. I'm pretty active.
So where on your hip does it hurt when you push on it, or where do you feel that?
It's on the outside, probably a little bit more towards the back than the front, I guess I would say.
Okay. Is it right on that bone, you know, when you press on that bone on the outside?
It feels more muscly than bone, I would say. Maybe behind the bone, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, you may have strained something when you opened the window. Are you not getting numbness or tingling anywhere?
No.
Okay. And you just woke up with it. So there was nothing that you did, no change in your activities. You didn't do a harder run or do more hills yesterday?
No, not particularly.
Okay. Just woke up with it.
Right.
Okay. And how's
your back was hurting yesterday, but the hip thing was new this morning.
Okay. You know, I mean, you can get radicular pain from your back to your hip, but typically if you can put your finger on a spot that hurts in your hip, that's generally the source of your pain. It's generally not referred. For pain that's referred from your back, it feels deep and you can't put your finger on a spot that hurts.
Right. Oh, okay.
So, you know, my guess is, you know, perhaps when you open the window, you really strained in your glutes, in your hips to open the window. It's also possible that with your back pain, you changed your movement patterns subtly, and so now you're developing a secondary hip pain. I would say, at 26, if your back's been hurting for a couple weeks and it's not getting better, I'd go in and see somebody and see if the hip pain is related to the back pain or what the source of the back pain is, and get you back on track before this spreads any further to additional joints.
Right. Okay.
All right, good luck. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate the call. And Jackie in Drummond, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Excuse me. This is a very frustrating problem. I'm an avid cyclist my whole life. You know, I've done bike trips and everything. Well, within the last 5 years, and just especially within the last year, this sounds so silly, I gravitate toward the left for no reason. You know, I'll be on a small shoulder, and then all of a sudden I'll be off the shoulder, and it just gravitates for no reason. And I've, you know, had physical therapy, talked about it, and I've had some balance. And I know I have scoliosis, I have a deterioration because I'm old on my back. But this is so frustrating and scary. I wonder why, just subconsciously, I gravitate toward the left. And about 5 years ago, somebody saw me and said, gee, Jackie, I was going up a hill, you gravitate toward the left. And that was not, I wasn't having any problems at that time. But I've gone, you know, the problem has gotten so bad sometimes that I've just gone over to the left side of the road.
So
what do you think is that?
Does it happen right away when you start biking, or do you have to be biking?
No, I just have to think about it. You know, I try to keep it on a straight line, but I have a really hard time veering, you know, staying to the right. And then when I'm on a small shoulder, that's what gets me. It's really hard for me to stay within the shoulder.
Okay. Do you notice it doing anything else?
No.
Well, good question.
You think wearing some type of an orthotic would help? I mean, to balance that leg out?
Yeah, but your whole bicycle is veering. I mean, you're steering your bike to one side, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you know when you're doing it? Can you tell that you're doing it?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
Okay, and then you're able to correct it?
Yeah, but it's kind of dangerous.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
I'm just have stopped biking with people and stopped going on bike trips, and it's been very
well. That's no good.
Yeah.
So you saw a physical therapist. How long ago? And was this the cause of you to go in and see the physical therapist?
No, I was having some back issues, and they were at a quandary and didn't really, you know, couldn't say too much about it.
Okay. You know, the only thing that comes to mind is whether you have a vestibular issue or something in your brain that's causing you to drift some side to side difference. I would discuss this with my primary, and there you could look at vestibular, you could look at visual, but it seems to me that your brain is causing that, may be at the source of this, whether it's intentional or not intentional, but there's something at a higher level that's causing this drift.
If you're putting more pressure on one leg versus the other while you're pedaling, that could have an impact in slightly how you would turn the handle of your bike a bit.
Potentially.
If you're putting more pressure, if you're using one leg harder than the other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seems as though that'd be something where, are you aware of doing that, Jackie?
No, not that much.
Okay.
Do you, when you see yourself start drifting, can you tell in your peripheral vision, do you see equal peripherally out either eye while you're biking, if that makes sense?
You know, I haven't really checked on that much, but, you know, I just try to control it, and it just, you know, if I'm on a, you know, regular road with no shoulder, you know, I can stay pretty much over. But so you think it could be some vestibular?
Vestibular,
like an inner ear kind of
thing.
And part of the reason that both Lori and I think about that is because you no longer have the input of your feet from the ground when you're on a bike.
Uh-huh.
That's why I asked you if you did it with walking or anything else. So you don't have that input of kind of knowing where you are in space. And so then you rely more on your vestibular system and your visual system to kind of align you.
Interesting.
So since we've knocked out your kind of somatosensory system,
then
I'm wondering
then we're left
if
with vestibular something at a higher level. So I'd go back to my primary physician and describe what's going on and how you're getting this drift, and see what your primary has to say, and maybe do a little bit more testing on that level.
Yeah.
One question, you know, I did go to a balance clinic about 4 or 5 years ago, and that kind of came off okay. But see, that wouldn't be dealing with the vestibular, though, would it? That would be just your...
Well, it probably deals with all three components of there's kind of three components of balance, and it probably deals with all three. And in that situation, you can rely more to get your input from your feet.
Uh-huh.
And when you're on your bike, you can't.
Yeah. So, have you ever heard of this before?
No. It's not fascinating.
Yeah.
It is very
good. Yeah, so call back and let us know what happens.
Exactly. Seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thanks so much for calling. And by the way, you guys are back on October 17th.
Okay. Perfect.
So when I'll be in Scotland.
You'll be in Scotland.
What?
Oh, man.
But the show will go on.
We will miss you terribly, Larry, but we know that you leave us in very capable hands.
Oh, man. Lori Tide Brody and Jill Tide Nissenbaum, our guests today as we talk with them about all kinds of physical therapy issues here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lori Tine Brody, physical therapist, athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, Jill Tine Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. And lots of callers here with physical therapy issues, so let's go to Doug next in Wilmot. Doug, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Hey, Larry, you're great. You're the best, man.
Thank you.
Okay, my problem. I get a knot sometimes every once a year, every 2 or 3 years, between my shoulder blade and my spine, and it makes my neck stiff. Well, the last time it's happened, after, I don't know, 15, 20 times, I'm 55 years old. This one, I felt the knot or the pain between my shoulder blade, my left shoulder blade, and my spine, but my neck wasn't too stiff. But my tricep started to quiver, my lat started to quiver, and my pec started to quiver. Now I've lost pretty much all strength from my tricep. I can't do a push-up. I can lift with my bicep. My fingers work okay. I play guitar. I'm a little hesitant to go. So it's kind of weird. It's different. It'd be a lot cheaper. Do you guys ever go to a chiropractor, or do I have to get the MRI and the EMG and all that stuff? Could maybe a chiropractor be okay?
My best guess is, based on your age, that you probably have some osteophyte formation or some arthritis or something that's pushing on a nerve root,
C7
nerve root.
I mean, if you're getting weakness in your arm and weakness in your muscles and in your triceps, I would go see a physician.
Right.
I would not stop anywhere in between, because you're getting progressive neurologic symptoms from something pressing on a nerve root, and at some point that becomes irreversible. So I would not pass go. I would go. How does that go? Go directly to go. Mm-hmm. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. I would go directly to see a physician and get this sorted out.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't do anything in between. I mean, if you want my advice, that's what it would be.
So the knot in your neck or back, the trigger point is usually just a symptom of the neck pain. So you've overused something and you get tight, and people think that's the cause, but that's not the cause.
Right. Are you having symptoms in your legs at all?
On my right leg, I'm seeing a orthopedic. I'm getting injections for my right leg. It's weak. I have a problem with a nerve in my lower back.
Okay.
This kind of came up. It was kind of familiar, but not too familiar. So I just kind of, it's been about 4 weeks. I was hoping to just get better. But
You need to take a look. Whoever's injecting your back would probably be the right person to look at your neck and upper back. And you want to make sure there's nothing going on with your central canal if you're getting symptoms in more places than one.
Right.
Yeah. Good luck.
It's not unusual to have that nerve root irritation above and below, like in the cervical spine and lumbar spine, because it's all connective tissue. Mm-hmm. And so if that connective tissue can be of poorer quality, depending on how you picked your parents. So there are people who, well, I had a herniated disc, right, and, you know, nerve root injury in my low back, now I have it in my neck. That can definitely happen.
Good luck, Doug. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let us know how it turns out, too. I'm always interested in cases. All these cases, it's always fun to know. Dennis in Red Granite, we turn to you next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I'm having hip surgery December 5th to repair a torn labrum.
Okay.
Just wondering what I should or should not be doing before the surgery and what kind of physical therapy I would be looking at after.
Well, those are great questions. So the one thing you want to do, so the labrum of your hip is somewhat like the meniscus in your knee, in that it kind of helps with shock absorption and kind of increases the congruency of the joint. So the one thing you don't want to do is anything where you're going to tear it more or end up with subsequent tears. So sudden, fast twisting movements or sports or activities that require cutting and pivoting would be ill-advised. Things that would be good for you are any cardiovascular activity you can do that doesn't increase your symptoms. And many times it may be swimming because it's non-weight bearing, potentially biking if the hip flexion doesn't bother you. And then some strengthening exercises would be ideal. So if you haven't seen a physical therapist yet, I would see one for what we call a prehab program, and get exercises that will make your recovery postoperatively so much easier. And postoperatively, most people feel pretty well. You might be in a hip spike, a brace, and on crutches for a couple of weeks. That's probably the most. You will be seen in physical therapy for some range of motion exercises, some hip strengthening exercises, core exercises, glute med, glute max exercises to get your strength back. But the recovery from most people having a labral repair is usually quite good.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Mark in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Love your show and love these guests.
Thank you.
My question is, and it may be slightly out of scope, but I'd be surprised if you don't have an opinion. I've been diagnosed. I've been diagnosed with focal dystonia in my right hand, specifically my right thumb. So my question really is it in your ballpark, and what, if any, advances are on the horizon? Anything that has any efficacy?
Those are great questions. Are you right-handed?
I am.
And can I ask how old you are?
60.
Okay.
So, you know, for those who aren't familiar, focal dystonia is these sort of uncontrolled spasms that you get. They can be generalized throughout the body, or they can be localized to one area. So Mark has it localized to his right thumb. It comes from a part of the brain where it sends these abnormal signals to the muscles saying, you know, contract, 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 and it's really beyond the control of the individual. You know, probably the primary treatments are some medication, some Botox injections. It's not really in my wheelhouse. We don't see patients. I see some patients with cervical dystonia for exercise. And that is, it's not really to treat the dystonia because there's no known cure for dystonia. But typically when I see people, it's try to help them find a way to exercise to maintain their general health in a way that doesn't aggravate or accentuate their dystonia. So I don't have any information on new interventions that are on the horizon for dystonia.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
No, yeah, thanks very question. Much for calling. Lisa in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lisa.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask about hip pain. I'm in my 60s, and I try to be as active as I can, you know, with walking and gardening and so forth. This situation has not been evaluated or diagnosed in any way, and it doesn't affect both hips equally. You know, it's sort of one or the other. Maybe one, the right one perhaps started with a mild stand and pivot kind of an injury. Walking up hills energetically will aggravate them. Things like raking might as well. You know, I don't think it's in the joint so much, but maybe the tissue supporting the joint. And I'm just wondering, you know, if this is something I have to live with in my mid-60s or not. Mm-hmm. The exercises that I do at home, it do have, you know, if I'm not careful, I can sometimes aggravate the pain. It's not serious pain, but it reminds me that...
Yeah.
That they're
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
I'm curious why you think it's in the muscle and not in the joint.
Well, you know, this doesn't radiate down the leg. There's no bone-on-bone sensation. It just seems to be where the pain is.
Okay.
It's a guess.
Can you put your finger on a spot that hurts?
Probably not.
Okay. Yeah, so then you always have to wonder if the primary source is your hip or if it's being referred from your back.
Ah.
So that's one of the questions. So have you seen anyone for this?
I have not.
Yeah, you know, I would start there because, you know, walking is important to you. And what we see in people is, you know, they have some pain while they're doing an activity. They make very subtle changes in how they do things. And most of the time, people are not even aware that they've made these changes. Mm-hmm. But when we look at people and we do a motion analysis with them, we see the differences. If you put them together in a group, you see the group differences in people who have pain and how they move. So, you know, And so getting in and getting seen and seeing if they can find the origin of this and giving you a few things to do to correct that, I think, well, you know, just think of it as a course correction to kind of get you back on track and prevent you from veering even further off
right,
course
right.
And make sure that you can continue to do the things you love to do.
Yes, indeed. And would this require any kind of x-ray or not?
Probably not. You could probably figure this out with a good clinical exam.
Mm-hmm.
A variety of tests of your hip and low back, looking at muscle length, muscle strength, flexibility. That'll do some tests that actually test the hip joint to see if that's the source of pain. And there are certain clusters of signs and symptoms that point to hip joint, that point to soft tissue, that point to low back. And so the physical therapist will do a series of tests and see if they fit into any of those particular patterns.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. You do know, I notice when I get a new pair of shoes, a new pair of running shoes, mm-hmm. how good it feels
right.
to have those. And you just, you're not realizing
right.
just something simple like that.
Well, and you make a great point, Larry, and it's very similar to Lisa's situation, a situation of many people where you have a very subtle, it's very slow and insidious,
yeah.
and you don't realize until you get to that tipping point how far you've come. So it's sort of like your shoes wearing out. They wear out so gradually that that you don't really notice the change until you get a new pair and you go, wow.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
Steve in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have two questions. One relates to my arm. I have a pain on either a tendon or a muscle that goes from the inside bone of my elbow kind of down toward my wrist. When I do exercise or work outside and stuff, it gets irritated. And then even when I set my arm down on the desk to work, like on my computer, mm-hmm. it will, that bone where it joins, mm-hmm. It will hurt. What should I do about it? And B, what can I, I do things like play pickleball and.
Oh, pickleball.
It gets sore when I do that, but it's sore even if I just do other things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's what we classically call golfer's elbow. So it's medial epicondylia. So most people, you hear about people getting tennis elbow, and that's on the outside. So on the inside of your bone, there's some muscles that attach there. And if you do have to do a lot of gripping and twisting, which you have to do with pickleball, right? You grip mm-hmm. a racket, right? That can be factorial. The other thing that lives there that may be irritated is your ulnar nerve. So your nerve runs relatively superficially down there, and it could be getting tugged on or irritated by how you're positioning your arm when you play pickleball, gardening, things like that. So it would be worth seeing a physical therapist to have those two things looked at. There's actually some gliding exercises you can do for your ulnar nerve, and then some strengthening exercises for your forearm and wrist. And then lastly, of course, looking at the grip on your racket for your pickleball racket, see how you're gripping with your rake and things like that, because that gripping is always a factor with those that pain too.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today as we talk physical therapy. We're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at physical therapy issues today, all those aches and pains and sprains and strains, with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Lori is a physical therapist, athletic trainer at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. Join in. Questions? We've got an open line or two. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. We're also going to deal with some email and Facebook mm-hmm. questions, too. Email at talk@wpr.org. Post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Elaine in New Berlin, who's been waiting a bit. Elaine, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a neuropathy in my toes, and I don't know if there's a way to figure out why a person gets that. If the tendency of, like, I didn't think I abused my feet, but I did run and take dance classes. I realized about 10 years ago that my feet didn't feel quite right when I was on ladder, and I let it go for a while, and then I went in and talked to my general practitioner, who said to go to the neurologist to see about that, and then podiatrist. I'd gotten some foot orthopedic insoles, mm-hmm. and they help quite a bit. I'm just kind of worried about if this would possibly progress up the leg. I don't know anything much about.
So, yeah. So Elaine, do you know the cause of it? Is it coming from your back? Is it in both feet? Is it just what we call idiopathic peripheral neuropathy?
I don't think that it's coming from my back.
Okay.
And I thought I had pretty good posture, but
okay.
My big toe and the second toe, years ago, I'd noticed that there was a lump there, a cyst.
Okay.
And they said it wasn't really necessary to have surgery or take out the cyst.
Right. Okay. And you don't have diabetes?
Painful.
Do you have diabetes, Elaine?
Pardon me?
You don't have diabetes?
No, I don't.
Okay. So, you know, diabetes is one of the big risk factors for numbness. So, you know, when people come in with numbness in their feet for no known reason, first we look to see if there's any metabolic or medical cause for that, such as diabetes. And then we look for musculoskeletal problems, such as issues in your back. You know, are you, then we start looking peripherally. Are you getting a nerve entrapment somewhere, someone around your knee, somewhere in your foot, your nerves can become entrapped. So we start hunting down the cause of it. And when we've really eliminated all those, then we sort of call it idiopathic peripheral neuropathy. And we're not sure what causes this in some people. It could be the structure of the nerves themselves. It could be the structure of the foot that places pressure on nerves, in which case you use the orthotics, as Elaine has done, and that seems to help. And thereafter, you know, we can't really say whose will progress. Some people's will progress up their legs. Others, it'll just stay in their toes. And it may be that from years of dancing and being up, if she was up on point or up on her toes a lot, that it put a lot of stress on those nerves, and it may just be confined to her toes. But I don't think anyone can really tell you at this point. So what you really need to do is to continue to use your orthotic, to wear good shoes, make sure you have good shoes and protect your feet.
Right.
Particularly if you don't have feeling in your toes, you need to watch that when you cut your toenails that you don't cut yourself. You need to not walk barefoot around your house to make sure you don't step on things because you don't necessarily know that you've injured your foot.
Right.
And things like that. And maintain your body weight. And continue to exercise because that increase in circulation and vascularity through the system is healthy for your tissues.
Good luck, Elaine. Thanks for calling. I think Mike in Milwaukee has something, may have something similar. Hi, Mike.
Hi, yeah. I'm an idiot neuropath, and I thought I'd call you because my feet are oversensitive. They get, you know, prickly. And,
okay.
And they're very sensitive to things. It isn't as bad as when I have shoes on and socks on as when I'm in bed. And I'm wondering if you've ever heard of that.
So you have, instead of Elaine, who had what we would call a hyposensitivity, a decreased sensitivity, you have a hypersensitivity. Is that correct?
I think so.
And have you seen physicians about this? And,
well, what have they said? I went to a general practitioner, and then he sent me to a surgeon.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to get surgery.
So what were they going to do surgery on?
Well, we never got that far. I just walked out on him after you know, $300 worth of MRI.
Okay. Well, okay. What did they MRI? Your feet
back.
Or your back?
The back. I had a herniated disc.
Okay.
But this came on before that happened. I actually fell out of bed and hurt myself. But I also have Dupuytren's contracture of the hands. I don't know if that complicates this whole thing.
I don't think so. I don't think they're probably related. So for people who have hypersensitivity, we do desensitization activities. So to back up, the first thing is if you do have a back issue, and depending upon what it is and where your disc is herniated, if you're getting progressively increasing symptoms, you need to go back and see your physician because it's a sign that you're getting too much pressure on a nerve in your back and you don't want a progressive neurologic problem. So having that out of the way, what I would say is desensitization. We have people put their limbs in water of different temperatures to get used to that, to take a washcloth or other kind of fabric and rub your feet to desensitize it. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of accommodating, learning the skin, learning to accommodate to that pressure of a sock, of a shoe, of different fabrics, of the sheet of your bed, and so on. And they do that for short periods several times during the day to see if they can desensitize it. Is it both feet or just one?
How do I find somebody in Milwaukee?
Well, I would start with my insurance, and usually your insurance will have a list of certain individual healthcare providers that you can see, and I would start with that. So
yep.
you, typically, depending upon your insurance, you may be able to go directly to a physical therapist who could help you with this. You may have to go to a physician first. It just depends upon your insurance.
Mm-hmm. So desensitization is the key word.
Yes.
I think so, yes. It's like your nerves are sending too much information and too reactive. So this is a method to kind of teach them to kind of, for lack of better terms, kind of calm down.
I can't thank you enough.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Thank you very much for calling. Amy in Kewaskum sent us a note. She found out last month she has a Baker's cyst and some arthritis in her knee. She now has a locking feeling in her knee.
Right. A Baker's cyst is basically, for lack of a better term, it's kind of when you get a bleb or a weakness.
A bleb.
In your knee joint capsule in the back. What happens is some of the fluid that's in that capsule escapes out the back, and then it gets stuck there.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a balloon, and there's a little offshoot of the balloon. So typically you get these because you have some sort of swelling or inflammation within your joint. So you usually have some arthritis or something like that going on. You don't get a Baker's cyst unless there's something sinister.
Right. So you realize that the inside of your knee joint contains fluid, synovial fluid. That's always there. It provides the lubrication for your knee. And if you have a weak spot in your capsule, kind of like a weak spot on your tire, and the pressure, particularly if you're weight-bearing or you're very active or whatever, the pressure sends that fluid out that weak spot, and it can get trapped there. Some people find that their Baker's cyst goes up and down based upon their activity level.
Or their knee position.
Or their knee position, right? And other people, it gets there and gets sort of stuck, and sometimes they'll talk about draining a cyst if it's really problematic. But in general, the idea is to control the swelling in your knee. So you backpedal to looking at your gait mechanics, looking at your strength, looking at your mobility, looking at your weight bearing, looking at your activity levels and your activity choices to try to keep your activity within your knee joint's tolerance.
And that kind of goes to the
next. Linda on Facebook, is asking what she could do for her Baker's cyst besides wrapping. It is aggravating with activity, especially on uneven ground.
So what's happening is on that uneven ground, she's loading her knee differently. So there's a part of part of her knee joint that's probably not used to taking load. And so what it does is it's getting inflamed and irritated. There's more fluid in there, and that fluid's escaping out into the Baker's cyst. So the wrapping will help kind of keep the fluid where it needs to be, but you're not getting at the underlying problem of why is this irritated in the first place? So in her case, maybe she needs a bit of a strengthening program to make sure that she has enough strength in her quadriceps and her hamstrings to offload her knee joint. Mm. So when she does walk on uneven surfaces, the muscles can absorb some of that shock, and so the knee joint doesn't absorb so much shock.
Michael in Darlington, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, how's it going?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was just curious. I just turned 23 in August, and I did something to my knee, and when I got an x-ray, they actually found that I have slight arthritis in it. I know I'm pretty young. I was kind of boneheaded in high school and
no.
didn't really go in for my knee problem.
Yeah.
I think I had patellar tendinosis or something. So I guess my question is, what can I do to get back to being active again?
Well, let's back up. You went in and you had a knee x-ray. Why did you have a knee x-ray?
I was at the gym, and I guess I kind of landed on my knee weird. It felt like it dislocated it, so I went in to get that checked out, and everything checked out, I guess, fine, but he did say that I had that slight arthritis already starting, which is bothersome.
Okay, so to the best of your knowledge, all your ligaments are intact and your meniscus is intact?
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge.
Good. Okay. All right. So,
well, first of all, you said you were at the gym, which is great. Mm-hmm. So there's already a really good start. It sounds like you do a lot to keep yourself active. Mm-hmm. The thing that you may need to do is make sure that you have a well-rounded program. So you have not only good cardiovascular endurance, but good strength in the lower extremity as well. Mm-hmm. So you could go to the hospital in Darlington and see a physical therapist there for one or two visits and get put on a really good strengthening program, rehab program, has all the components, and you could do that.
Yeah, the biggest factors for holding off arthritis are A, maintaining a healthy body weight. Maintain a healthy body weight. Can't emphasize that enough. Followed closely by quadriceps strength. That's strength in the big muscles in the front of your thigh, because they are the shock absorbers. And people often say, well, arthritis is in my joint. How can physical therapy help? And what we can tell you is there is a large body of research that shows that people who have weakness in their quadriceps are more likely to develop arthritis. Your quadriceps take the load off of your knee. Every time you take a step, your quadriceps absorb the load of your body weight hitting the ground. If you're walking, you know, about 0.7 times your body weight. If you're running 2 to 3 times your body weight, it's going across your knee joint. So you want your quadriceps to be able to absorb and dissipate that load and not push it onto the joint itself.
Right.
Okay. I have gone to the physical therapist before. I do...
Uh-oh.
Oh, we lost him.
Well, sounds like he's at the gym. Mm-hmm. He's gone to the PT before.
I'd go back again if it's still a...
Well, and if it's maybe his exercises need to be changed or modified. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe he needs some sort of modification or tweaking in his program.
You've said that in the past. If you, after months, your body changes and
tune
you
up,
need...
Right.
Tune-up.
Tune-up, exactly. Mm-hmm. He should have quadriceps like Alex Erickson, who's from Darlington.
Kathy on Facebook says her 12-year-old granddaughter is a very intense basketball player. What can she do to prevent injury?
That's a great question. First of all, 12 is a very young age to start thinking about weight training or things like that. I'm going to go out on this limb and...
You go.
Really?
You go.
You okay?
I won't saw you off.
Okay, good.
I'll catch you.
There's a really fascinating study that came out looking at the use of lace-up ankle braces to prevent ankle injuries.
Oh, yeah.
And it was done here in Madison. Fabulous study. Won lots of awards. And it really showed that wearing lace-up ankle braces prevents first-time and recurrent ankle sprains in high school athletes. Now, we drop it down a couple years for this individual. And it doesn't send the load up the chain. So, in other words, those people didn't have more knee injuries or back injuries or hip injuries. So, as much as I love good old-fashioned strengthening, balance, proprioception programs, you have to think about the compliance of somebody doing a program at this age versus putting them in a lace-up ankle brace. And I hate to admit it, but it would be worth considering lace-up ankle braces to prevent ankle injuries.
Yeah, well, then there was just an article in Orthopedic PT Practice that showed that the knee kinematics changed when you were wearing an ankle lace-up brace.
Yeah, well, there's
so
that.
The jury's still out, so watch that. So that's stay tuned.
Right.
Film at 11.
Right. Yeah.
So there's that, but the other thing I would do is get her into a good ACL prevention program. There are many of them out there, and a thoughtful coach would bring somebody in, if the coach didn't know how to do this, him or herself, would bring somebody in to do a 1 or 2 time training program on ACL prevention. And I know basketball coaches who invite athletic trainers and others in to meet with their basketball team and teach them proper landing technique to prevent ACL injuries. So I would get her in an ACL prevention program. They're also, I'm sure, available online.
Right. Yeah. Yep. There are lots of them for free.
Bruce in Oakwood Hills, Illinois, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Okay, I have my doctor says a strange problem. It's been going on about 15 years. I wake up at 2, 3 in the morning with a pretty severe ache in the side of my neck. And so in the beginning it was pretty extreme, so it's gotten to where it's not quite so bad, but it's more frequent. When it started, it was... it would happen. It would be maybe up to 2 days, and then it would be gone for 2 weeks. Then it would be back a week later on the other side of the neck, a little less severe. So I started trying, you know, the chiropractor and massage therapy, and I've seen all the doctors. I've had a MRI that says I have spondylosis, but my doctor says I shouldn't do what I'm describing.
You've changed pillows?
Oh, yeah. I have every pillow invented. I've tried... you know, I tried a low-dose antidepressant for the pain. That didn't do anything. So now this year it's been every week, and this month it's been every other day. And I have quit going to the chiropractor for a year or so and the massage just to see what would happen. But it's a lot less severe. but it's more often. So I'm not sure if I'm getting better or worse. I've been taking glucosamine pretty steadily to see. So if I get up, take Excedrin, sit upright for an hour, it usually will go away. If I don't get up, it just won't go away. And it's always when I'm sleeping.
And can you put your finger on a place that hurts?
Usually it's in a very small spot right on the side of the neck or the base of the skull, one side only. But occasionally it's across the whole back of my neck. But, you know, I'm not sure if I'm getting a normal headache
right.
at those times.
So,
but I do seem to be sensitive back there, you know, no matter what's going on.
Have you had, like, an angiogram looking at a Chiari?
Right. Atlanto axial instability, is that what you're thinking?
Yeah. Or either, Atlanto axial instability or a Chiari, because I'm wondering why he gets better when he sits up. Almost everybody I know with back pain or neck pain are worse when they sit up and they need to lay down.
Right.
But I'm thinking if he's got a Chiari.
Mm-hmm. What is a Chiari?
Arnold Chiari malformation.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, for lack of better terms, kind of a kink in your vascular supply.
Mm-hmm. At the base of your
skull. At the base of your skull.
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
Arnold then hyphen Chiari.
What was the first word?
Arnold.
Arnold as in Schwarzenegger.
Okay, Arnold, and then what?
Chiari.
Chiari.
Something like that.
I think it's close. Google it.
Malformation.
It'll Just have, because that's, you are right. That's not, you are correct that that's, you should be better. And it doesn't sound like it's musculoskeletal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jinx.
There we
God.
Go.
I'm in the store. I don't have a pencil, so it's Arnold what?
Chiari.
Chiari.
Okay. You just do Chi, you'll probably get it. Malformation.
Malformation. So, you'll get it.
Blood flow related.
Yes.
Okay, I'll check it out.
That'd be the
All right.
Thing.
Good luck. Thanks, Steve. And Jason and Madison. Hello, what's on your mind?
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple questions. I'll try to be as brief as possible. Just in the last couple of weeks, this is undiagnosed because I haven't been to my physician yet, but I feel like I have a herniated disc in my upper back, and that lasted about 3 days. And then 2 days later, I was just laying in bed, and I coughed, and then I threw my back out again. That lasted another couple of days. And all meanwhile, like, I couldn't even, like, it almost radiated around to the front of my chest where I could pressure on my chest and feel the pain in my back.
Mm-hmm.
And even my hair touching my head would even hurt a little bit. And then when I lay on my back, my second question was, and I was wondering if this was related, is my hands would tend to go numb.
You need to see somebody.
Go see somebody now. Do not pass go. Do not collect
$200. These are very unusual and weird symptoms that I don't necessarily, you can't really correlate as being something musculoskeletal.
Yeah.
I would go see your physician.
Yeah.
Okay.
Too many... unusual things. It's not one. You have a lot of symptoms
have
that don't
heard
all fit
of,
together.
People just sporadically having their hands go numb when they're laying on their back or while they're sleeping, they wake up with numb hands.
Well, you sometimes you can because of your elbow position, but you know,
usually
this
with your arms overhead
or with
like
your
that.
Elbows flexed. Elbows
usually
flexed.
Be if I'm holding my phone up or something while I'm laying on my back.
Yeah.
My hands are turning numb.
Yeah. And I
thought maybe it was related with the back pain.
It may be.
Yeah.
So, you know, the typical cough and back pain is a disc, could also be a compression fracture. So there's enough unusual stuff going on. I would go in and report all these symptoms and have someone examine you just to make sure that it's a bunch of disparate, unrelated things.
Right.
Yeah,
especially because his soreness was for 3 days. I mean, you cough and you have this back pain for 3 days. That's not right.
and so good luck, Jason, and thank you so much for calling. And Laurie and Jill, thank you. We're totally out of time. You'll be back on October 17th and do this all over again.
Excellent.
Sounds like a plan.
Look forward to it.
Have a great time in Scotland.
Yeah.
I will.
So jealous.
Yeah.
It'll be fun. Laurie Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the University of Wisconsin. Laurie is a therapist and athletic trainer in the Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.